Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Shawley, bringing the best of my Times radio show. It's politics at the boring bits, Monday to Friday, 10 till 1, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times radio app. Coming up on today's episode, regular listeners to the radio show will remember that last year we counted down every leader of the opposition who didn't make it to number 10 with Nigel Fletcher. Well, as a result of that, he's turned it into a book. Somebody's written the foreword for it, but it's not for me to say. Anyway, Nigel Fletcher is back talking about his book on all the people who didn't quite make it to being Prime Minister. That's our big thing coming up in a moment. We've got James Marriott and India Knight talking all sorts of nonsense as well. But first, as we always do on a Friday, let's take a look at what we learned this week. We learn that Rupert Murdoch is stepping back as our big, big boss to be replaced by his son Lachlan, which is excellent news all round and not something to make jokes about. Good morning, boss. We learn from Gillian Hardhat Keegan that the kids just love that their proper schools are falling down.
I've been to a number of these schools and seen children and met children in the porter cabins. And in fact, at the first school I went to, the children were all petitioning me to stay in the porter cabin because they actually preferred it to the classrooms.
We learn that Liz Truss is back.
I'm having a rather more relaxing September than I did last year.
Yeah, aren't we all, Liz? Aren't we all? We learned that Boris Johnson has broken the rules over taking a column at the Daily Mail without getting permission. I know, totally out of character.
I believe that what we were doing was within the rules.
We learned that Labour's party conference slogan is Give Britain Its Future Back, although much better was Times Radio listener James Thomas, who suggested, are we nearly Blair yet? We also learned that, shockingly, that massive Remainer and former second referendum cheerleader, Keir Starmer, quite likes the EU.
We don't want to diverge. We don't want to lower standards.
Prompting Tory Minister Mark Spencer to go all out on him on GB News.
Look, we don't really know what he's saying. He's flip-flopping about, as he doesn't seem to have a clear policy, and he seems to make it up on the hoof on occasion. So I think, clearly, it's very difficult to define what he does stand for.
I mean, it certainly takes some gumption to decide that this week, of all weeks, is the time to mount a campaign accusing your opponent of being a flip-flopping, indecisive policy Mr. Wibbly-Wobbly.
The proposal that we should force you to have seven different bins in your home. I've scrapped it.
And that is what we learned this week. Now it's time for these two.
The Columnists with Knight at the Marriott. India Knight and James Marriott.
I was hunched on my bedroom floor over my laptop, frantically battering away at my column.
On Times Radio.
We say hello to India Knight. Hello, India Knight.
Hi, good morning.
How are you, India? Are you better?
I'm very well. That Yvonne Fair song, It Should Have Been Me, is one of my favourite songs of all time.
Oh, good.
Yeah,
nice.
So good.
Nice. And you've kicked the COVID.
I've kicked the COVID. Still tiny bit croaky, but completely fine otherwise.
You do sound much better, which is nice. Just, you know, keeping regular listeners updated on the
thank you very much
on the ailments of staff. James, how are you?
I'm well, yeah, thank you.
You're fighting fit?
Yeah, ready to
go. I'm glad to see you've got most of the buttons done up on your shirt.
Yes, I decided to appear in a state of full dress today in the newspaper, which is not always my habit recently.
Yes. What were you doing in the paper earlier in the week?
I was sent to Paris to dress up as Serge Gainsbourg for a photo shoot on Monday, and this involved the very nice but very forceful French photographer unbuttoning most of the buttons on my shirt and then taking pictures of me because it made me look apparently louche, which I'm not sure it really did. Just maybe I think I look slightly frightened in those pictures. You can see the fear in my eyes.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you look like a louche French.
I'm not sure what could transform me into a louche French person. She also made me smoke 3 cigarettes at once and I felt like I was going to faint.
So let me...
For one of the pictures.
Here we are. This is the picture. Yeah, well, I mean, you're doing your best to sort of pout, but your state of undress does look more like you've been the victim of an assault.
That is, yeah, sadly very true.
Well, for the benefit of people who haven't seen it, I'll tweet the link to it now.
Please feel free to...
Yeah, we are discussing this now. There we are. So you could go have a look at that.
Everyone immediately will tune out when they realise no one's going to tune in to listen to that.
There's a lot of buttons under. And what's really helpful is that they've put next to you a picture of Serge Gainsbourg with Jane Birkin, where he's wearing a shirt and a jumper and not in a state of undress. So it looks even more ridiculous. But anyway, there we are. Let's move on and talk about what is on the front of the Times today. Rishi Sunak is drawing up plans for a radical reform of A-levels with a new style of British baccalaureate under which children would study more subjects after the age of 16. It's all part of what he thinks you should do English and maths compulsory up until the age of 18. You'd have a sort of a broader experience until later in life. What do you think of this, India?
It seems to me that every government tries this. Everybody agrees it's a good idea. I seem to remember, who was it, Cameron? Ruth Kelly. Ruth Kelly committing herself to it about whatever it was, nearly 20 years ago, and she just couldn't get it through. The problem is people really, really believe that A-levels are good. People understand A-levels, people really like them. And so I think, you know, I think it's likely to meet, as it always has done in the past, with governments of both sides. I think it'll meet too much resistance. But fine, yeah, absolutely. Then you wouldn't have people like me who wander through life not being able to count.
Yes. James, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's when you realise you've really become a grown-up is that you start thinking, yes, everybody should study maths to the age of 18, which obviously I'd have been utterly despairing about when I was 18, and I would not have, my entire career would have stalled there because I was really terrible at maths. Again, probably an indictment on our society that, you know, such unqualified people are allowed to write newspaper columns. Yes, it's clearly a good idea. The idea of studying compulsory English to 18 is also good. I hope they'll be studying lots of poetry, obviously highly useful for going through life, as I've discovered. But that seems to be less the focus of people's debate on this issue.
Although one of my sort of takeaways from it is if this to happen, and you can argue about whether or not, but given you've got to stay in some sort of educational training until 18 now anyway, it would seem to make sense that you were as qualified in English and maths as you possibly could be. It just renders GCSEs to be even more pointless.
Yeah.
And my daughter's school, because part of the argument for this is, you know, you end up narrowing at 15, you end up making decisions about subjects you're going to do at A-level, and that's too young to choose. My daughter's school is doing the GCSE still over 3 years. So she's just started year 9. So at the end of year 8, at the age of 13, she was choosing her GCSEs. So if the argument is we should be, you know, not narrowing, let's do something about the pointlessness of GCSEs.
That's a really good point. I mean, I can see an argument for some choice, but yeah, to be in year 8 and suddenly deciding that you might never ever learn, you know, French again or something,
yeah,
is just right. And something you might easily regret by the time you're 18.
Yeah,
it's a very weird way to do it.
I think it's also a question, not GCSEs, A levels or baccalaureates. It's a question of what qualifications are actually designed for. So vocational qualifications are designed specifically to get people into jobs. A-levels or the baccalaureate or the international baccalaureate is designed to get you into university. And you can't fluff the difference. You can't say, oh, this new thing can be vocational as well. Yeah. So that, I think, needs looking at too, because otherwise you're going to get a whole kind of cohort of people who are sort of no longer really properly catered for.
What A-levels did you do, James?
I have the fluffiest A-level record ever. English literature.
Lovely.
Ancient history.
Yeah.
And French.
Of course. I mean, we could have guessed.
Yeah, from my Serge Gainsbourg photo shoot I started preparing early.
I'm surprised. Yeah, I should have realised it probably wasn't mechanics. What did you do, India?
French, English and Italian.
Oh.
Very cultured, very civilised.
A bit more useful than later. I did English literature, history and philosophy.
Ooh, he's worse than me, in fact. Sort of fluffy, get you.
Yeah.
And I did French for a year, and I just couldn't get on with it, so I dropped it. And now it annoys me, because it's the one thing that is more useful.
Yeah, someone should really say, look, it's really boring when you're 17 years old, but in 10 years' time, you're going to be in France trying to order a baguette, and you'll feel so cool if you can do
having
it in the language.
Having your shirt unbuttoned by an aggressive...
Yeah, exactly. 10 years' time, you're going to be in the streets of Paris being laughed at by French pedestrians as a woman aggressively unbuttons your shirt and tells you to look like Serge Gainsbourg.
Well, I mean, I think the main takeaway from this is the number of people... I've just looked up, actually. Yeah, Ruth Kelly was talking about... there was talk of a baccalaureate exam in 2005. And it's been talked about by almost everyone since. And this is a Rishi Sunak, it's an idea he floated during his leadership campaign last year, was put on hold, now it's come back. If it does happen, it wouldn't be until after the election. And, I mean, even, Michael Gove and all the effort he put into overhauling GCSEs, it's been slightly overtaken by, technology and all of that. So, yeah, could possibly be an interesting idea. It doesn't feel like it's one that's going to happen anytime soon. Right, let's move on then, James. Talk about your column this week. And who have you been attacking this week?
Darren Grimes is my target this week.
And why? Well, first of all, explain who Darren Grimes is.
So I don't know, I feel a bit mean now. I shouldn't really start picking on him so much. But he is a, in my view, slightly boneheaded commentator on politics.
I should stop being rude about him.
I know.
The first adjective you were reached for was boneheaded.
Well, what's a better word for boneheaded? Like a more polite, what's a more polite word? Maybe not always the best informed commentator on politics.
Right.
And my column was bemoaning the fact that instead of experts and people from universities telling us about how politics and science and society works, we're now subjected to people who are less well-informed, such as the aforementioned commentator. And this was coming out of reflecting on Russell Brand's weird time when he was briefly adopted in the kind of 2010s as a kind of intellectual figure. He wrote a book called Revolution. Ed Miliband had to go and talk to him in his kitchen about why democracy was actually a good idea. He was on Newsnight, and I was saying he should never really have been accepted as an authority on anything much. And it's a kind of slightly depressing trend that lots of comedians are now kind of reinventing themselves as public intellectuals who are worth listening to.
Well, yeah, you're right. So it's not just Darren Grimes who you singled out a lot. It was a person on GB News. Down in the most squalid depths of the intellectual food chain, appeal of crass pundits such as the GB News regulars Sophie Cochran and Darren Grimes stems precisely from their ignorance. But not just them. The Australian comic Hannah Gadsby curated an exhibition of Picasso, gratifyingly panned by critics. The illusionist Derin Brown is moved into philosophy. Nish Kumar is a politics podcast. Ricky Gervais has smugly installed himself as a partisan of enlightenment and reason. None of these figures have any claim to expertise other than their fame.
God, it just sounds angry when you read it out like that, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
It must have been cross.
Like all the letters to points of view, they all sound cross when you read
on Wednesday,
like that.
On Wednesday morning.
And another thing. What do you think of this, India? Is James right that people should have expertise? Or is there a danger of sort of gatekeeping by the clever people?
Well, I think James is right in that it's always good if people have expertise. I also think that politics in particular is incredibly boring and is populated by incredibly boring people, or people who come across as very boring in their public television persona, even though they may have expert knowledge of the thing that they're talking about. So you can't blame people or TV channels for booking people who are a bit lively, which I think is how the Brand thing started. The thing I find really sinister about the Russell Brand thing is that clearly he was aware that stuff was going on in the background and that people were asking questions. And then he completely sort of rebranded himself first as a political pundit and then as some sort of guru, as far as I can see, or cult leader. Anyway, you can't blame people for wanting to listen to people who are engaging, vivacious, amusing, make serious points using humor, etc., etc. So I sort of think two things. I think, yes, there is a danger of gatekeeping. I mean, why shouldn't Nish Kumar have a podcast about politics? Everybody's allowed an opinion. Everybody's
making so many enemies.
But, you shouldn't have one, because I've got one. And we won't be able to download my politics podcast. That's more.
That is the main reason. That's next week's column.
Yeah.
But I think that I personally would rather listen to people who knew their stuff.
Yes. And I suppose it's difficult, isn't it? Because part of the reason why you hear the same people on all the same outlets is because quite a lot of people aren't very good at broadcasting.
That's true. I mean, I guess what...
As I demonstrate most mornings.
No. I guess what I'm really saying is not get rid of amateurs altogether, but let's not let the whole thing be overtaken by them. I was also having a bit of a go at university, so I think, you know, I'm not doing a very good job of allowing people who work at universities who are actually experts on stuff to get into public life and to become broadcasters and stuff, because they're all buried under work and forced to learn kind of preposterous jargon.
They're not even marking the exams. What are you doing?
Well,
I've got plenty of time to come on the radio.
Well,
that's the sort of thing that's going to get me.
Yes, you get lots of angry letters from academics. Yeah. But I think, I don't know, I was also saying universities have this kind of responsibility to public life, and people who actually know about science and who know about, you know, vaccines and stuff should be being pushed out and said, you know, don't, you know, marking is the less important thing. An important thing is to go and talk to the public and educate them.
Yeah.
And they're being buried under bureaucracy, and therefore, you know, all this stuff gets taken up by mad people who think that vaccines don't exist.
I think I agree with James Marriott. Says someone on the text. That's your... What's your dad's name?
It's not David, it's Richard. So that's actually not my dad.
But wouldn't newspapers struggle to find columnists if they had to have expertise? You three might be the exception. Nicely recovered there, David. Let's move on, because I want to talk about food, which is one of my hobbies, and India's an expert in this. The government has got a target to reduce food waste by 50% by 2030, but it's abandoned mandatory food waste reporting by businesses, which makes it difficult to research how much food is actually being wasted. And this has been talked about in the House of Lords yesterday. So here is Joan Bakewell, Labour peer, Baroness Bakewell, questioning the Tory peer, Lord Harlech.
If the government does not know the level of food waste, how is it going to ensure that food poverty is not increasing and edible food is not going to landfill?
My lords, I sense we're going over the same ground a little bit here, and I can only reiterate what I've said already. It makes a good sense for businesses to reduce their food waste. However, the overwhelming amount of food waste in this country, 70%, comes from individual households. Therefore, it is about educating and helping individual households and consumers to buy what they need, use what they buy, and waste as little as possible.
No, I'm not an expert. That's definitely not Joan Bakewell. But anyway, it is someone in the House of Lords talking about food waste. You must know what to do with our food leftovers so we're not wasting food, India.
Yeah, I do, but it's really difficult. You know, with the best will in the world, there's, at least in my house, always going to be something left in the fridge that you don't quite know what to do with and that's on the turn. Even if you shop really carefully. I mean, I'm not anywhere near a supermarket, so I tend to buy what I need for the next couple of days and try and use it up. But even doing that, it's really hard. You know, particularly if you buy planning particular meals, there's always some leftover bit of something that doesn't sort of go in with anything else. I must just mention this app, because my stepdaughter was telling me about it, who's a student, and it's called Too Good To Go, and lots of students use it. And it is an app that hooks you up with supermarkets and restaurants who bag up the food that they would otherwise throw away and sell to you for,
that's good.
30 quid's worth of food you can buy for like a fiver, but you don't necessarily know what's in the bag. So you slightly have to play ready, steady, cook when you get it home. But that's a really good way of that food, you know, not going to landfill or not just being chucked. It's so wasteful. I can't bear it.
There's nothing that I did it the way. There's nothing I like more than making a massive bolognese and putting some of it in the freezer. James, your short thoughts on food waste.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, does it count if you never actually get the food, the old food, into the bin? It just stays in the fridge for weeks and weeks and weeks. is it actually waste? I suppose eventually it is, but I certainly, you know, the fridge holds a lot of my rotting food, unfortunately.
Well, there we are. Right, so we've done talking about bringing food back from the dead. What about bringing back your loved ones? Reanimating the dead with computers isn't new. You've seen Carrie Fisher in Star Wars and Tupac on stage, sort of, with Snoop Dogg all the way back in 2012. But the development of AI means it could become a possibility, not just for films, but for ordinary people too. Dr. Deborah Bassett advises tech companies on their treatment of the dead, is the author of The Creation of an Inheritance of Digital Afterlives. And Deborah, you can explain what digital necromancy really is.
Well, if you think about it, it's been going on for quite a few years. It's a conjuring up of the dead. So it is anything that any technology that uses the dead brings them back to life in some ways. And my research has been looking after the service providers that do this. So it looks at service providers that that offer the facility of bringing the dead back to life, or offering the facility of bringing you back to life after you die. So it's conjuring up of the dead. Ouija boards were probably the first.
So when we say conjuring, is it reanimating what, videos, holograms, voice messages? How does it actually work beyond just, you know, the advice, just take lots of photos and videos while people are alive and you can look at them later?
Well, it's exactly that. It is reanimating. So in some ways you can get somebody that has sat, and they are intentional digital creators, as I call them. So they have sat with multi cameras in studios, and they have purposefully created media to be used after they die. And then there are people that are accidental, what I call digital zombies.
Would you want to do this, James? Do you feel like the sound of this?
Sounds creepy to me. I'm not in favour of any form of necromancy.
So you would want a do not reanimate order, which apparently is a bit like a do not resuscitate order.
Oh, yeah,
so
don't reanimate me. I can't believe many people would want to.
Would you want to be reanimated, India?
No, I'm really horrified by this idea, actually. I mean, I can see how, you know, I can see how, of course, if you're mourning loved ones, it would be tempting. But I think after a certain point, I don't care to think about it. I do not care for it. No thanks.
Would you do it, Deborah? I know this is the world you work in, but the closer you get to it, are you planning, are you filming yourself now so you can be reanimated?
No, I want people, after I die, I want people to remember how I was in life, not how I was in death. That's why I came up with the digital do not reanimate.
Yeah.
I wrote a code of conduct for this industry, having studied it for 6 years and done my PhD in it. So I wrote a code of conduct that I'm hoping these companies will adopt. And it basically tries to encourage tech companies to think about how these are inherited afterwards. So my feeling here is, just because you can doesn't mean you should. However, it can be done sensitively, so that when it is inherited, when these memories and messages are inherited, as long as they have been done sensitively, with sensitivity at their core, they can bring some comfort to those left behind.
It's ghosts, though, isn't it? It's really digital ghosts. It's living with the...
I mean, imagine if the technology improves, if it's not a hologram, you'd have like a robot walking around the house with your dead husband's face on it. It'd be very peculiar. Very odd. Anyway, it's fascinating, if slightly alarming. Deborah, thank you for that. Dr. Deborah Bassett advises tech companies on the treatment of the dead and is the author of The Creation Inheritance of Digital Afterlives. James Marriott and India Knight there. You can read them both in The Times and The Sunday Times each and every week. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next, it's the leaders of the opposition who never quite made it to the top job.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work.
You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're listening to the Redbox podcast. Now it's time for this.
The Big Thing on Times Radio.
Leader of the pack.
Memories. The best montage for the best radio feature. You can't always get what you want. Where we took a look at every person who'd been lead of the opposition and not made it to number 10. God, they're good, these, aren't they? Every week. Last year, we were joined by Nigel Fletcher, who's from the Centre for Opposition Studies, came on the show and we went through a different leader of the opposition who never made it to number 10, one by one, every week, telling us about their life and political career. And because everyone's got a political book out right about now, Nigel Fletcher has turned it into a book. And here it is, The Not Quite Prime Ministers, Leaders of the Opposition, 1783 to 2020. With a foreword by someone called Matt Chorley, which seems unlikely. But bringing together all of the failed opposition leaders, and I'm delighted that Nigel joins me now. Hi, Nigel.
Morning, Matt. I can't tell you how much I've missed that montage.
That was the extra special long one as well, which we had to cut back after the first couple of weeks of doing the feature because it took up much too long. So remind us how this was born. We'd done the prime ministers, a different prime minister every week the year before. But actually, you know, history is written by the victors. And this was a way of telling the stories of those who failed, or actually just as useful. For instance, if Keir Starmer is wondering about the pitfalls, the risks of not making it to number 10, the people who didn't quite make it might be less well known, but it doesn't mean their stories aren't worth telling.
Yes, and in so many ways, this book is entirely your fault, Matt. Because, I mean, my obsession with opposition is quite long-standing. But when you invited me on the show to do the sort of rundown of leaders, you gave a golden rule, which was that we couldn't repeat anyone that Andrew Jimson had done the previous year. So we had to do the losers. And that really gave the whole thing sort of a whole new dimension because, you know, I've studied sort of periods of opposition, but you do sort of find yourself kind of looking with quite a lot of interest at sort of, you know, Harold Wilson and David Cameron and, you know, all of the leaders who Blair, obviously, who became prime minister and looking at their period in opposition. But when you rule all of them out and just look at those who didn't make it, you get a whole new perspective on it. And as you say, it's the lessons that you can draw from those who didn't quite make it. And I think the one of the biggest lessons is that, you know, there's so much luck in politics, you know, the sort of fickle finger of fate or whatever you want to call it, that we like to think that it's all about sort of how good you are, how good your policies are, whether you sort of connect with the electorate. But so many times it's actually just about the kind of sheer bloody-minded sense of humor that fate has for people, you know, and the number of people who've just been ruled out by either a personal issue, by their health, by dying in a number of cases, or just the fact that, you know, it just wasn't their time. And in another time, they might have been a really good leader. So I think that's the lesson, is that when we look at these people as failures. We had a big debate, actually, with the publishers, whether to make the subtitle Failed Leaders of the Opposition. And in the end, we decided that that was a bit unfair. It was a bit cruel.
Sometimes failures. Dying will really hamper a political career. So let's go back to the beginning then. 1783. And it starts with the Whig leader, Charles James Fox. Why start there? Because even trying to get a handle on who was and wasn't a leader of the opposition is quite hard in those early days. So why start there and with him?
Well, the reason for starting with him is because, just like with the prime ministers, it's quite difficult to sort of find who was the very first one. And with the prime ministers, everyone says that the first one was Robert Walpole. And that's generally because he emerged as the biggest figure in government. He became sort of the king's first minister. And therefore, he was accused of being prime minister as a bit of an insult, that, you know, he was assuming that he was the preeminent. But he was a big figure and he was in office for a long time. And so that happened sort of earlier in the 18th century. And the same really happened with opposition. There were lots of people who were the opposition, who were opposing the government, including to Walpole. There's books being written about, you know, how opposition coalesced in opposition to Walpole. But you didn't really have this one single figure that you could say that person is not only the head of the opposition, but also the person who is the de facto candidate to be prime minister from the other side. So the reason for starting with Fox is he was that big figure. He was in opposition for 22 years from 1783 onwards. But he was also somebody who really could have been prime minister. And he probably thought he was going to be, because he was the leader when you had the crisis with George III's illness, which was dramatised in The Madness of King George, the Alan Bennett film. And had that happened at the time, had the king sort of been removed and the prince regent sort of taken office then, it's very likely Fox would have then entered government and been his prime minister, because the king had and the prince regent would have had a big say over who was prime minister. But that didn't happen. And so by the time George III was replaced by the prince regent, Fox was dead. So, you know, he wasn't around to do that. Yeah, but he spent 22 years in opposition. He's such a huge figure, commanding presence in the Commons. So really, I think he is the kind of Walpole figure on the other side, that he was the one who coalesced as that big figure.
It's really interesting that. And you know that someone's got longevity in politics when, you know, people were defined about whether or not they were followers of Fox, even after he'd sort of stepped back from politics. Let's jump ahead a little bit, because we need to talk about George Tierney, not least because, as a result of, this is the most meta conversation ever, as a result of us doing the feature, which has now become your book, it's also become a chapter in my book, which is the duel. So George Tierney was leader of the opposition, or at least speaking from the opposition benches, when he had a row with Pitt the Younger, who was prime minister.
Yes, and I mean, if you research this, you probably know more about the duel than I do, but there's some great cartoons I'm sure you've seen as well from people at the time. This was a big deal. I mean, the prime minister going and having a duel on Putney Heath. But people forget who the person was that he was having that duel with. And this is George Tierney. And he was not leader of the opposition at the time, although he was an opposition figure. This was 20 years really before he became that sort of leader. But he was speaking in Parliament about a defence issue. Britain was at war with France for one of the many times that happens. The Entente Cordiale that we've currently got going on wasn't always the case. And so, you know, you had a highly charged sort of debate, and basically Pitt, the Prime Minister, accused him of a lack of patriotism. And like with a lot of things in this book, you know, we can relate to a lot of this. You can imagine those kind of debates in Parliament where someone raises some questions about military strategy and the Prime Minister sort of says, oh, well, you know, why do you hate Britain? That kind of thing. So this is what happened. He accused him of a want of patriotism, is the way it's been described. And Czerny sort of, you know, wasn't having that and sort of asked him to retract. He didn't. And so he called him out and sort of said, you know, I want a duel. So, you know, people on both sides were saying, you know, guys, this is really not a great idea, and tried to dissuade them. But yeah, they met on Putney Heath for the duel. And what I haven't quite got to the bottom of, and you might be able to help me on this, but is, you know, I don't really know much about the rules of dueling, but they both missed and they're 12 paces apart. So either... they're both, you know, very poor shots, or they were doing it deliberately, and this was just a kind of, you know, they have to shoot the gun to make it sort of a thing. But they shot sort of, I think, two rounds at each other. The second one, Pitt fired into the air, so he was deliberately trying not to hit him. But I don't know about Czerny whether he was actually trying to kill him. But well, yeah,
lots of the cartoons of the time made much of the fact that it's basically fair to say that Czerny was a larger man.
He was stout. Yeah.
And as a result, was possibly a broader target,
yes,
in the way that Pitt the Younger, in the way that,
yeah.
Pitt. So luckily, that's not happened again. I think the king even wrote to Pitt and said, that better not happen again. And it didn't.
Yes.
But let's move in then to the 19th century. This idea, yeah, of a leader of the opposition becoming a sort of adornment of the constitution, if you like. Let's start with Spencer Cavendish. Why have you picked him out?
Well, I mean, blatantly, the reason I've picked him is that I love his nickname. He was the Marquess of Hartington when he was the leader of the opposition. So he was in the Commons, and his nickname was Harty Tarty, which I love. And I mentioned that on the show last year, that I just like that nickname. I hadn't quite got to the bottom then of why it was. And the reason he was given this nickname is, again, a bit like Fox. He had a colourful private life, and he had a long-running... relationship with a sort of high society courtesan, whose nickname was Skittles. And there's this great story, which I really want to be true. It's got all the hallmarks of being apocryphal, but it said that he went on a visit somewhere, and the mayor of the town he was visiting had put a visit to a bowling alley on the itinerary. And he sort of went to this bowling alley and sort of questioned, sort of like, you know, why are you showing me this? And they said, well, the Prince of Wales, future Edward VII, who was a friend of his, the Prince of Wales, sir, has told us you're a great fan of Skittles, which is a great practical joke, and I'd like it to be true. But he's got this lovely name, and also he's got a connection to Eastbourne. I put in the book that there was a this gay pub in Eastbourne that I used to go to called the Hartington, and it turns out that it is named after him. So that's quite a nice personal link, where I said in the book, you know, in the late 90s I used to go there occasionally and may have been either Harty or Tarty, but you know, I have to say, you know, fair disclosure, the book is full of these kind of silly anecdotes that I think are sort of just as important as the serious history. But the serious reason he's in there is because basically he shouldn't have qualified for the book, because he effectively led the Liberal Party in the House of Commons to an election, won the election, and was then asked by the Queen to form a government. So you'd think, well, you know, why wasn't he Prime Minister? Well, the reason he wasn't Prime Minister was because Gladstone just sort of stuck his oar in and decided he wanted to be Prime Minister again. He'd sort of stood back during that Parliament, didn't do all the hard work of being leader of the opposition, because he wanted to go and just, you know, write tracts about theology for 5 years. So Gladstone's gone off, you know, to do that. And then when they win the election, you know, he comes back for the campaign. I think there's shades of Boris Johnson in this somehow. There's something about him that sort of, you know, he comes back into the campaign and decides to be a big figure in the campaign. And then you sort of, you know, get to 1880, the election, and the Queen asks Hartington, who is the leader of the party in the Commons, to form a government. And Gladstone basically says he won't serve under him. And they can't have the government without Gladstone in it. So effectively, they have to say, well, you're going to have to ask Gladstone, I'm afraid. And the Queen Victoria wasn't very happy about that.
She famously did not.
Absolutely loathed him. Yeah.
Did not get on with him. Okay, let's jump ahead, because we've got so many to get through. Jump ahead to the 20th century. And some of those that sort of get slightly overlooked. Let's talk about Hugh Gateskill, who was the leader of the opposition 1955 to 63. And then died. And actually, you know, he was a Labour leader on the cusp of power
who then died, and it was Howard Wilson who replaced him, who went on to become Prime Minister. The parallels with the early 90s, the death of John Smith and the rise of Tony Blair are so stark. Let's just have a look, because we're into the 20th century, so we've got some audio. This is Hugh Gaitskell in 1960 speaking at the Labour Party conference as he faced down challenges from the left of his party.
Let me repeat what Manishin will said. The place to decide the leadership of this party is not here, but in the Parliamentary Labour Party. And I would not wish for one day to remain a leader who had lost the confidence of his colleagues in Parliament.
Just explain the significance of Hugh Gaitskell, because it was going on about it. There was a chapter about him in my book as well, and it is extraordinary how significant really he was in mid-20th century politics, and was on the cusp of becoming Prime Minister if the polls were to be believed, and it's sort of just disappeared out of our sort of political reference points.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think I vaguely knew the name when I first started studying politics, and it wasn't really until I sort of got sort of properly into studying it that I realised quite how significant he was. Because you know he was leader for a long time. He was there for 8 years, and you know it was that 1 year short of the election that he died. So. During that period of opposition, you've really got sort of, you know, the full sort of spectrum of, you know, he had a very poor election result in 59. He mounted the policy review to try and move the party into a new direction. There was a huge debate in the Labour Party at the time over sort of what being a democratic socialist meant in the modern age, all of that sort of stuff. So he oversaw all of that. And also you had this ongoing division between the Gaitskellites and the Bevanites in the Labour Party. So all of that, he was at the centre of all of those really important debates in the mid-20th century Labour Party. And as we heard there, you know, there were the two famous conference speeches that he made, one on his commitments to moving the party away from unilateral disarmament, and also he made a very important speech about the party's position on Europe. So a number of issues where he was sort of really taking on his party, and on clause four, you know, he tried to review clause four decades before Blair successfully did
exactly.
it.
Yeah,
he
yeah.
failed to do it. So, you know, and I think if you look at, and a lot of my students I find sort of get onto this when they talk about modernization of the Labour Party, a lot of them like to do this comparison and look at sort of Gaitskell as the forerunner for Blair, and there's a lot in that. But I think you have to say that Gaitskell was probably sort of the forerunner, we might get onto in a bit, of Neil Kinnock, in the way that he took on the party, you know, and did all that hard work.
And I suppose actually that's the thing, isn't it? If one of the measures of being a successful leader of the opposition is, did you become Prime Minister? Which obviously everyone in your book failed on that. But did you get your party closer to power than it was before? You know,
exactly.
on both, you know, sides, Labour and Conservative, sometimes there's a sort of job of work to be done there. In fact, I think we've got a little clip of Neil Kinnock actually, when he told me why he thought the public ultimately voted for John Major over him.
I was a Marmite figure, he was a Marmalade figure. You could go for a pint with him, you could bear living next door to him. Whereas with Mrs. Thatcher, if you were living next door and the kids were playing football in the street and the ball went into her garden, they'd never knock the door to ask for it back.
I just love that story. I thought the Marmite versus Marmalade is just a really good way of summing up politics. Nigel, we've now reached the 21st century, where, you know, actually both the Conservatives and the Labour Party have had quite a lot of leaders of the opposition.
An embarrassment of riches, isn't it?
Yes. I don't know what that tells us about the state of our politics. Let's turn our attention to Ed Miliband. When you need to prove that you are ready for the top job of being Prime Minister, there's a problem, you have to keep on saying it.
Am I tough enough? Hell yes, I'm tough enough.
But actually, unlike quite a lot of the leaders of the opposition, he's still around. He could well be in the cabinet in the event of a Labour government.
Yes, and that's another lesson that I draw from the book and the lives of all of these so-called failed leaders, is that actually a lot of them go on to do significant things later on in their careers, or have done significant things in their careers before they take on the mantle of leading the opposition. So you have, you know, lots of the Victorian ones, you know, they've been in high office, they've been in the great offices of state, and then at some point after an election, you know, where the prime minister sort of goes off and they take over the leadership for a bit, having been a senior figure. But there's other people who, you know, being leader is not the end of their career. William Hague is a very good example of someone who obviously then went on to be foreign secretary and a fairly well-respected senior minister after his very unsuccessful time as leader of the opposition. Ed Miliband is another interesting one. If he goes on to be a cabinet minister again, that will be very similar to a lot of the leaders that we've seen in the book.
It's interesting, those people who, being leader of the opposition, ends up being a sort of blip in their careers. Yeah. Before, and you know, William Hague's another example of someone like that, probably. Whereas others, it ends up being the height of their career. For instance, Jeremy Corbyn, who regular listeners to the show will know, ended up, according to our listeners, being voted the best prime minister we never had. We ran a Twitter poll. We had a bit of fun on a bank holiday Monday. We ran a poll, the best prime minister we never had. It ended up being a contest between Jeremy Corbyn and Charles Kennedy. And Jeremy Corbyn ended up winning, and we thought it was just a bit of fun. And then he recorded this.
I'm not sure this Twitter poll gave the result that a lot of our media pundits really expected, or possibly even the one that they wanted.
He recorded a victory speech, slightly weirdly, in a bush. What does the story of Jeremy Corbyn tell us about what happens to some leaders of the opposition, and where does he sort of fit into the great pantheon?
Well, he's a very interesting character, and, you know, surprisingly, because he was in office for quite a long time, for one thing, you know, we've got quite a lot to look at. And having two general elections is also quite unusual. You know, prior to him, Kinnock was the only other one to have led his party at two elections and survived to fight the second one. And in Corbyn's case, you know, he had sort of opposite ends of the spectrum. On the first one in 2017, he massively exceeded expectations. And in 2019, led his party to the worst defeat since 1935. So, you know, you've got both ends of the spectrum in terms of expectation management there. But he's also fascinating for the sense that he tells us something about what we expect from leaders of the opposition. So, there are things like the sort of Privy Council. The first row of Corbyn's time as leader was whether he was going to go to Buckingham Palace and kneel before the Queen to become a Privy Councillor. And, you know, he was asked in an interview by Laura Kunzberg at the sort of start of his leadership, are you going to do that? And he didn't know. And he sort of, you know, equivocated about it. It was the first scandal. And then you have the press saying, oh, you know, he's disloyal and all this sort of thing. But it's this unconventional sort of aspect of someone who's so anti-establishment, someone who is an out-and-out sort of, you know, anti-establishment Republican. He's a left-winger. But we have had leaders like that before. You know, it's quite surprising if you go back to even into the 18th century. You've got leaders there who, you know, were going and speaking at protest rallies against sort of, you know, rather hardline government measures. You've got people who were sort of speaking outside the House of Commons to sort of crowds of people and going and speaking on platforms with radical leaders, you know, and Fox and others were criticized for it. So it goes back a long way. And then you have people like George Lansbury in the 1930s, who was, you know, a very left-wing Labour leader. He'd been a minor cabinet minister in the second Labour government. But when he led the party, you know, he ended up having to resign over his pacifism, which made way for Attlee. But Lansbury, you know, was a very left-wing figure and very similar to Corbyn in many ways. Completely unsuited, really, to being a leader and never expected to be. Again, similar to Corbyn. So we think that Corbyn was such an unexpected and sort of unprecedented leader. But there really are parallels in some of these stories.
There are always parallels. Unprecedented. Yeah. Be banned in politics because almost everything has happened almost identically previously. Now, obviously, there's a reason why the book stops in 2020, because we don't yet know if Keir Starmer would make it into the book, because if he becomes prime minister, he'd then be disqualified. And, you know, from what you've been saying, the fact that that's even an open question now, 20 points ahead in the polls, shows that, you know, he's done a lot of that work as leader of the opposition. Let's look into the future then. What does Keir Starmer need to do in the next year And then what does, if he does win and he becomes Prime Minister and disqualifies himself from your book, what does the next Conservative Leader of the Opposition contest look like?
Mm. Well, I think, I mean, Starmer, I think, you know, has got this dilemma you always have as Leader of the Opposition between sort of just attacking the government constantly and saying everything they do is terrible and also being responsible. And I think in recent months, he's started sort of having that problem where, you know, he's being asked and his shadow cabinet being asked in interviews questions as though they're already the cabinet. You know, they're being asked, you know, would you agree to this pay deal? Would you know, all of those technical sort of quite small details, they're having to sort of, you know, be asked about them. And that's always a danger when you become sort of held to account as the opposition in that way. But for the next leaders of the opposition, let's assume that Labour win the next election and the Conservatives go into opposition. The thing I would say to them is they have to be prepared for what William Hague describes as the night shift. You know, everyone sort of wants to be leader of their party if they're an MP, frankly. And but you know, their time, you know, may come at the worst possible time for the party. You know, William Hague's been asked, you know, do you regret standing for leader at that time? Would it not have been better to wait? Well, he said, you know, firstly, you know, you can't just postpone it and say, oh, well, I'll be leader when I'm ready. You have to take the opportunity when it comes. And also he said that he doesn't think anyone else would have been able to hold the party together at that time. And someone had to do it. It's a phrase that Kinnock's used as well. Yeah. You know, someone had to do it at that time. So I think that, you know, there will be maybe a clamouring of people who want to be leader of the opposition after an election defeat. But I think they should ask themselves, are they prepared, frankly? Are they prepared to be in this book? You know, are they prepared to spend sort of 5 years of their life or more, in some cases, knocking their head against a brick wall, only to actually make very little progress and not Prime Minister at the end of it?
Yeah, well, it'll be fascinating to see how that unfolds after the election. And you know, and if Keir Starmer doesn't become Prime Minister, does he get the opportunities like Corbyn and Kinnock to carry on, or is he turfed out like all the Tory leaders certainly in the 21st century as well? Nigel, listen, it's fascinating. I love the book. I was very pleased to be asked to write the foreword for it. And I'm glad that, you know, I look forward to more features from Times Radio being spun off into a book empire. So, Nigel Fletcher, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
The Not Quite Prime Ministers, Leaders of the Opposition, 1783 to 2020 by Nigel Fletcher, is out now. And that's all we've got time for on today's episode of the podcast. I'm going to spend the weekend packing my bags for what's going to be a quite annoying tour of Britain, doing the Lib Dem Party Conference in Bournemouth, the Tory Party Conference in Manchester, the Labour Party Conference in Liverpool. And yes, because somebody emailed in about it, we'll be covering the SNP conference as well, in the interest of fairness all that. But for now, for me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.